Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program of news and feature reports is designed for people learning English. Today, I have a report on what scientists know, suspect, and do not know about Zika and unborn babies. Later, Phil Dierking has a story about how photography is helping children cope with cancer. And as always, we close the show with an American story. Today, we listen to part one of The Blue Hotel by Stephen Crane. Three years ago, Brazil experienced a major sudden spread of the Zika virus. Doctors learned that the sickness can cause severe development problems for unborn babies. Here is a look at what scientists know today about Zika and its effect on fetuses. Zika began spreading in Brazil in April 2015. The country's Ministry of Health recorded more than 260,000 probable cases in 2016. It also recorded in the first 2 years more than 2,500 cases of babies born with very small heads, or microcephaly, and other problems linked to Zika. The numbers dropped sharply in 2017, with fewer than 18,000 Zika cases and 300 cases of microcephaly. So far this year, Brazil has seen about 2,200 cases of Zika and 20 cases of microcephaly and other developmental abnormalities. Many viruses, like rubella and HIV, can cause microcephaly. Exposure to poisonous chemicals can also cause it. Sometimes microcephaly is the result of abnormal genetics. Since the 2015 outbreak, a group of experts organized by the World Health Organization found that Zika is also a cause. But scientists noted that Zika appeared to lead to microcephaly more often in northeastern Brazil than it did in other places. They are still not sure why, said Ganeshwaran H. Mochida, a pediatric neurologist and researcher at Boston Children's Hospital. Scientists also wonder why an increase in microcephaly cases was not reported during past Zika events. It could be that an increase was not noticed, or that the events were not large enough to produce many brain abnormalities. One study has suggested that a recent mutation to the virus may have made it more likely to cause microcephaly. Mochida said, "This may not be the whole story. I don't think that this explains everything." Children with microcephaly can have substantial nervous system disabilities that affect vision and hearing. Some will never learn to walk or speak. Scientists are still studying the effects of less severe cases. Microcephaly does not necessarily reduce a person's life expectancy, but it can lead to other problems that do. For example, many children have trouble swallowing, which makes them likely to breathe liquid or food into their lungs. This can lead to the lung disease pneumonia. Zika has also been linked to other problems in babies, like seizures, restricted ability to move, and poor balance. Scientists are still trying to learn if Zika may cause problems that appear later in a child's life, even for a baby who appeared healthy at birth. No vaccine is currently on the market, though several are being developed. Scientists at the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases have developed the best possible vaccine so far. It is being tested in 16 places in the United States, the Caribbean, and Latin America. Dr. Anthony Fauci is director of the agency. He said approval for the vaccine could come in 18 months if scientists get data from a future outbreak. Barring that, approval could take 3 or more years.
At 15 years of age, American Madeline Morales has lived through experiences most young people do not have to deal with. Morales has faced cancer. She has used anti-cancer drugs and radiation treatments to fight the disease. But she is hopeful about her condition and tries to find beauty through her camera. Morales takes her camera everywhere she goes. She is always looking for something interesting to shoot. Today, she will see something most people will never see in their lifetime. Morales was one of 23 students who shared their experiences with cancer through pictures at a show in Los Angeles, California. Their photographs can be seen at the offices of the Pavlov Foundation in Los Angeles, California. All of their students attended its advanced photography class. The Pavlov Foundation tries to improve the lives of children living with cancer through its Shutterbugs photography program. The group also provides money for children's cancer research. Any money made from sales of the students' photos will go to cancer research. The Pavlov Shutterbugs program offers photography classes in 8 cities across the United States. Ashley Blakeney directs the program in 4 of the cities, including Los Angeles. She said, "Being in these classes with other people that completely understand their experience and can be a community with them has been really impactful and has really made them feel a lot more comfortable in what they've been through and where they're going with it." Blakeney said the photography classes give students living with cancer a feeling of community at a time when they often feel very alone. Photography also helps the students feel better about themselves and their abilities, she added. She also said the program helps the young people think about things other than their condition because it takes them out of the hospital. Because they are able to build this skill set and to be the really great photographers that they are, in a sense that they can now say, "I am an artist, I am a photographer, I have this voice, and I have this story to tell," she said. The photos of Bayou Lukman, another student, can be seen at the show. Lukman learned he had cancer after finishing elementary school. He found the emotional part of living through cancer and its treatments to be difficult. but he said that most of his photos are about hope. You kind of get really depressed and you don't want to live anymore, he added. You need to stay optimistic and push yourself through. With photography, many young students see the world with hope, where their identity is not only controlled by cancer. There's more to us than just having cancer, that we have more of a story to tell besides cancer. We want people to see what we see, even if it's through the lens, said Morales. Pavlov helped me understand more about the struggles of cancer and has given me a small chance to actually assist in the world a bit with photography. I'd say to express my story and allow it to reach other kids so they understand how to deal with it, hopefully, said Lukman. I'm Phil Dierking.
Now, here is Alice Walker with a preview of this week's What It Takes podcast from the American Academy of Achievement.
If you go to LinkedIn and look up Reid Hoffman's profile, this is how he describes himself: entrepreneur, product strategist, investor. It actually takes a little work to find the part where he says he's the guy who came up with LinkedIn. He created it, and he helped start the revolution in social networking. These days, what he mostly does is help other entrepreneurs get off the ground.
One of the metaphors I use for entrepreneurship is you jump off a cliff and you assemble an airplane on the way down.
Reid Hoffman is talking a little fast here, so let me rephrase. His metaphor bears repeating anyway. Being an entrepreneur, he said, is like jumping off a cliff and assembling an airplane on the way down.
To do this more intelligently, you're choosing your cliff, you're choosing when, you're preparing yourself with the right materials, the right teammates to jump over the cliff with, these sorts of things. But sometimes you just have a love of this technology or this area and you stumble your way into it. So it's not, you can be more systematic, you can increase your probabilities, you can increase your scale of outcome. But also sometimes, people are just like, they happen to be doing something they love and all of a sudden the commercial models and venture and everything else goes into it and all of a sudden it's off to the races.
You can hear the whole program and get the transcript on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Now it's time for an American story.
The Blue Hotel, Part 1.
The Palace Hotel at Fort Romper was painted a light blue, a color of blue found on the legs of a certain bird that makes it bright in any surroundings. The Palace Hotel then looked always loud and screaming in a way that made the bright winter scenes of Nebraska seem only a dull gray. It stood alone, and when the snow was falling, the town 200 yards away could not be seen. When a traveler came from the railroad station, he was obliged to pass the Palace Hotel before he came to the group of low houses, which was Fort Romper. It was believed that no traveler could pass the Palace Hotel without looking at it. Pat Scully, the hotel owner, had proved himself a master at choosing paints. It is true that on clear days, when the long lines of trains swept through Fort Romper passengers were surprised at the sight. Those that knew the brown reds and the dark greens of the eastern part of the country laughingly expressed shame, pity, shock. But to the citizens of this western town and to the people who stopped there, Pat Scully had performed a wonder. As if the displayed delights of such a blue hotel were not sufficiently inviting, Scully went every morning and evening to meet the trains that stopped at Romper. He would express greetings and welcome to anyone he might see hesitating. One morning, when a snow-covered engine dragged its long string of cars to the station, Scully performed the marvelous trick of catching three men. One was a shaky and quick-eyed Swede with a great, shining, cheap bag. One was a tall, sun-brown cowboy who was on his way to a job near the Dakota border. One was a little silent man from the East Coast who didn't look like it and didn't announce it. Scully practically made them prisoners. He was so quick and merry and kindly that each probably thought it would be cruel to try to escape. So they followed the eager little man. He wore a heavy fur cap pulled tightly down on his head. It caused his two red ears to stand out stiffly, as if they were made of tin. At last, Scully grandly conducted them through the door of the Blue Hotel. The room which they entered was small. It was occupied mostly by a huge stove in the center, which was burning with great force. At various points on its surface, the iron had become shiny and glowed yellow from the heat. Beside the stove, Scully's son, Johnny, was playing a game of cards with a farmer. They were quarreling. With loud words, Scully stopped their play and hurried his son upstairs with the bags of the new guests. He himself led them to three bowls of icy water. The cowboy and the Easterner washed themselves in this water until they were as red as fire. The Swede, however, merely placed his fingers in the bowl. It was noticeable throughout these proceedings that the three travelers were made to feel that Scully was very kind indeed. He was giving out great favors. Afterward, they returned to the first room. There, sitting about the stove, they listened to Scully shouting at his daughters, who were preparing the noon meal. They employed the silence of experienced men who move carefully among new people. The Swede was especially silent. He seemed to be occupied in making secret judgments of each man in the room. One might have thought that he had the sense of foolish fear which accompanies guilt. He looked like a badly frightened man. Later, at dinner, he spoke a little, directing his conversation entirely to Scully. He said that he had come from New York, where he had worked for 10 years as a suit maker. These facts seemed to interest Scully, and afterward he told that he had lived at Romper for 14 years. The Swede asked about the crops and the price of labor. he seemed hardly to listen to Scully's lengthy replies. His eyes continued to wander from man to man. Finally, with a laugh, he said that some of these Western towns were very dangerous. And after this declaration, he straightened his legs under the table, nodded his head, and laughed again, loudly. It was plain that this had no meaning to the others. They looked at him, wondering and in silence. After dinner, it was decided to play a game of cards. The cowboy offered to play with Johnny, and they all turned to ask the Swede to play with the little Easterner. The Swede asked some questions about the game, learning that it wore many names and that he had played it under another name. He accepted the invitation. He came toward the men nervously, as though he expected to be attacked. Finally seated, he looked from face to face and laughed sharply. This laugh was so strange that the Easterner looked up quickly. The cowboy sat with his mouth open, and Johnny paused, holding the cards with still fingers. Afterward, there was a short silence. Then Johnny said,
"Well, let's begin. Come on now."
They pulled their chairs forward until their knees touched under the table. They began to play, and their interest in the game caused the others to forget the strange ways of the Swede. Suddenly, the Swede spoke to Johnny.
"I suppose there have been a good many men killed in this room."
The mouths of the others dropped open, and they looked at him.
"What are you talking about?"
said Johnny. The Swede laughed again, his loud laugh, full of a kind of false courage.
"Oh, you know what I mean, all right,"
he answered.
"I don't,"
Johnny protested. The card game stopped, and the men stared at the Swede. Johnny evidently felt that as the son of the hotel owner, he should make a direct inquiry.
"Now, what are you trying to say?"
he asked. The Swede's fingers shook on the edge of the table.
"Oh, maybe you think I haven't been anywhere. Maybe you think I don't have any experience?"
"I don't know anything about you,"
answered Johnny.
"And I don't care where you've been. I just don't know what you're trying to say. Nobody has ever been killed in this room."
The cowboy, who had been steadily gazing at the Swede, then spoke.
"What's wrong with you, fella?"
Apparently, it seemed to the Swede that he was powerfully threatened. He trembled and turned pale near the corners of his mouth. He sent an appealing glance in the direction of the little Easterner.
"They say they don't know what I mean,"
he remarked bitterly to the Easterner. The latter answered after long and careful thought.
"I don't understand you,"
he said calmly. The Swede made a movement then, which announced that he thought he had met attack from the only place where he had expected sympathy, if not help.
"I see that you are all against me. I see..."
The cowboy felt as though he had lost his senses.
"Say,"
he cried, as he threw the cards fiercely down upon the table.
"Say, what are you trying to do?"
The Swede jumped up.
"I don't want to fight,"
he shouted.
"I don't want to fight."
The cowboy stretched his long legs slowly and carefully. His hands were in his pockets.
Well, who thought you did?
He inquired. The Swede moved rapidly back toward a corner of the room. His hands were out protectingly in front of his chest, but he was making an apparent struggle to control his fright.
Gentlemen,
he almost whispered,
I suppose I'm going to be killed before I can leave this house.
A door opened and Scully himself entered. He paused in surprise as he noted the terror-filled eyes of the Swede. Then he said,
What's the matter here?
The Swede answered him quickly and eagerly.
These men are going to kill me.
Kill you?
Shouted Scully.
Kill you? What are you talking about?
The Swede put out his hands helplessly. Scully turned upon his son.
What is this, Johnny?
The lad had become ill-tempered.
I don't know,
he answered.
It doesn't make any sense to me.
He began to pick up the cards, gathering them together angrily.
He says a good many men have been killed in this room, or something like that. And he says he's going to be killed here, too. I don't know what's wrong with him. He's probably crazy.
Scully then looked for explanation to the cowboy, but the cowboy simply shook his head.
Kill you?
Said Scully again to the Swede.
Kill you? Man, you're crazy.
Oh, I know,
burst out the Swede.
I know what will happen. Yes, I'm crazy. Yes, yes, of course, I'm crazy. Yes, but I know one thing.
There was suffering and terror upon his face.
I know I won't get out of here alive.
Scully turned suddenly and faced his son.
You've been troubling this man.
Johnny's voice was loud with its burden of undeserved blame.
Why, good God, I haven't done anything to him.
The Swede broke in.
Gentlemen, do not trouble yourselves. I will leave this house. I will go away because...
He blamed them with his glance.
Because I do not want to be killed.
You will not go away,
said Scully.
You will not go away until I hear the reason of this business. If anybody has troubled you, I will take care of him. This is my house. You are under my roof. And I will not allow any peaceful man to be troubled here.
He looked threateningly at Johnny, the cowboy, and the Easterner.
Don't, Mr. Scully. Don't. I will go away. I do not want to be killed.
The Swede moved towards the door, which opened to the stairs. It was evidently his intention to go at once for his bag.
No! No!
Shouted Scully commandingly. But the pale-faced man slipped by him and disappeared.
Now,
Scully angrily to the others.
What does this mean?
Johnny and the cowboy cried together.
Why, we didn't do anything to him.
Scully's eyes were cold.
No,
he said.
You didn't?
Johnny repeated his words.
Why, this is the wildest madman I ever saw. We didn't do anything at all. We were just sitting here playing cards, and he...
The father suddenly spoke to the Easterner.
What have these boys been doing?
The Easterner thought again.
I didn't see anything wrong at all,
he said at last, slowly. Scully began to shout.
But what does it mean?
He stared fiercely at his son.
I ought to beat you for this, my boy.
Johnny was wild.
Well, what have I done?
He screamed at his father.
That is all the time we have today, but we will be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Hope you will join us then. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.